There's a Hasidic Jewish story that I love. It's about a rabbi and his young child. Now, his child was one, I don't know, maybe late elementary school in our conceptions, and he loved to go wander in the woods, far out of sight, far out of earshot, far away from being able to be called back when he needed to be, or to be protected from whatever danger lurked in the woods. Now, at first, the rabbi didn't think much of this. He noticed this pattern in the mornings, in the afternoons, in the evenings, in which his son would leave their little village and wander out into the forest. Then he got a little concerned. That sense of parental freedom was being overrided by that other sense of parental fear. Maybe you know that. And so he decided to ask his son. He called him in one day and said, "I've noticed that each day you go and walk in the woods. I wonder why you go there." And his son responds in probably the perfect way to respond to your rabbi father. "I go there to find God," he said. Perfect response. How could you argue with that? Now, his father was no slouch. Being a rabbi, being an educated man, he turned to his son and said, "Son, it's good that you're going to look for God. That is something that I want you to do in your life. But just so you know, and I hope you do, well, God is the same everywhere. So do you really need to go into the woods to find God? Maybe you could stay where I can see you." His son, looking at his father, replied, "Yes, I know that God is the same everywhere, but I am not. I am not the same everywhere." And I heard a murmur. You know that feeling, right? That sense of being out in the world, out in nature, beside mountains or lakes, gazing at stars. You know that sense of being different out there, right? Where are the places that most cultivate that sense for you? You can just shout them out. Sorry? Mountains? Canyons? Ocean? The Pooter, by lake, deserts, home. It's amazing how that if we probably went on for long enough, we would name every single geographic feature of this planet, right? Because even if deserts don't speak to you, mountains probably do. And even if the ocean is not one for you, the wide expanse of prairies will do it. As I was thinking about writing this sermon, I realized that I probably shouldn't spend my whole time writing the sermon about the land in a coffee shop or in my bedroom. So I decided to just take a 4-minute drive out to the Maxwell Natural Area just over here. Now, on the scale of natural areas, not the best natural area, right? I mean, you got Overland Trail going down there. I mean, they took down the old arena so you can see a little bit more. But even though it has a little bit of a deficit of natural beauty, as I was walking down the trail, I heard this noise which sounded like rain. The sun was hitting my skin and it was warm, and yet I was hearing rain. And I looked up and I saw a clump of aspens, their leaves dried. The wind that I didn't feel touching me was touching the branches tall at the top of their, and it was rustling. Rustling like rain. And I was wrapped. I was caught up. I was caught up in this moment of sensual experience, of feeling the way that those trees were growing, the way it was hitting me. The Unitarian minister Kendall Gibbon speaks about these moments as moments of primal reverence. She says, the situations are so familiar that they are pretty much cliches. You stand at the shore with the waves beating out their rhythmic crash and the water rushing almost to your feet, seeing nothing but a thin line of the horizon where the sea meets the sky. The distance suggests infinity, the ocean's unfathomable depth and power, its ceaseless primordial force and mystery. Something within us unlatches, she writes, and expands in that immensity, catching some hint of our finitude, the oneness of all life emerging from the sea's embrace eons ago, the sovereign beauty and freedom of so much overwhelming space and light and sound. Perhaps for you, it is the stars at night, somewhere beyond the reach of our puny interfering city lights. The whole sky is filled with uncountable rays originating from billions of light years away, planets and galaxies beyond imagining, made of the same stuff we are. And you stand amazed in that shower of brilliance. Or perhaps you taste your tastes run into the deep forest or the towering redwoods or the stable, stunning ribbons of color of the Grand Canyon or the suspense and drama of a thunderstorm. That's me. Or the reflections of sunset on a hidden lake or the unfolding green of the garden coming back to life after winter's severity. Somewhere, this planet has a showstopper for you that takes your breath away and makes you tug on other people's sleeves to make them see what you see. You know those moments, right? The land evokes in us a primal reverence. And I know when I am standing in the midst of a thunderstorm or looking up at the sky, I am filled with this experience, and maybe you are too. I'm filled with this experience of feeling insignificantly small. And yet, beautifully a part of it. That my significance or my smallness doesn't negate my part in it. That I am part of something beautiful, part of something bigger, part of something larger, part of something mysterious and wondrous, part of, not separate, not an observer looking at, but within, part of home. Nothing can destroy that connection that is within us, that connection of like for like. Lucy Lepard, author of The Lure of the Local, says, no matter how far culture will go to destroy its connection to nature, humankind and all our technology, good and bad, are inextricably part of nature. The original determinant, the mother and matrix of everything, that all pervasive structures that lie beneath scenery, landscape, place, and human history. Now, growing up, I was not a person that liked nature. I just didn't. I preferred technology and people. And I resented being dragged camping and hiking. I could look at a picture of the top of the mountain. Why did I have to go there? And yet, this is just the land combined together again, isn't it? Get to hear and connect to stories of your living, of this life. There is actually no way to disconnect us from it. Now, yesterday when I was doing Aaron and Richie's wedding, the ceremony had finished and their young daughter, Vienna, and I were hanging out. It was the photo part of the day, which I didn't have much of a part in, nor Vienna had a part in it, but she was done. She's about five. And so her parents had smartly packed her a lunch to get over, you know, the hunger and exhaustion and excitement of being at this wedding. It was outdoors. We were in this beautiful place. And so she was sitting down eating her peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And we got to talking. At first, we were talking about rainbows because she likes rainbows. And her parents had got her this beautiful little crystal necklace that was refracting the light, sending rainbows all on the rocks we were sitting on. And so we started to talk about how all of those colors were in the light. That was pretty astonishing to her. And then I tried to up the ante a little bit. I said, and did you know that everything you're eating in that peanut butter and jelly sandwich is a plant? I mean, we had to break it down. We had to talk about jam and sugar and bread and flour and grain, but we got there. And so I said, how are your plants? And she said, delicious. And then I tried to go a little bit step further. She was holding her water bottle, drinking some water. And I said, do you know that you are drinking a cloud? Ew, she responded. But then we talked about the cycles of water, the way our bodies take it in, how the nature cycles it all through, how the water that was in the lake would someday be in a cloud, that would be in an ocean, that would be in her water bottle, that it was this beautiful cycle that we are a part of, that we are a part of it, and it was wondrous. Our interdependence is easy to forget, and it is too important not to remember. And yet, we live in a society dominated by a Western story that doesn't believe in interdependence. It's a story that cleaves us from the land, creating this interesting false dichotomy, and I wonder if you've noticed it, a dichotomy between humanity and the land, a relationship of power and dominance. I'll give you one example of maybe where some of this came from. Genesis chapter 1. And God said, let us make man and let them have dominion over the fishes of the sea and the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all of the earth. I always thought it was the cattle, get a specific call out there. And over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. For many of us, nature is something that needs subduing. An other. Nature, in fact, many of us define it as a place where humans are not. Right? This is not nature. That's nature, but not around the places where the people's houses are. That's like a bubble zone. It's like crossing over. That nature becomes a resource to be developed or mined. It's purely physical. It has no moral or spiritual or cosmic character, nor does it have any ethical demands, that its value of this world is conceived through solely our gaze, and thus it's something that can both be feared for what it does to us, and it does do a lot to us, and it is something that needs to be controlled, mitigated, and yet it is both uncontrollable and also inferior, right? That's the story that we're told. The story of progress, of development, of this Western expanse of people taking over for our good, taking from this world, not thinking what we put back into it, that we are somehow out of this cycle. Neil Smith says, placing nature on a pedestal as ultimately uncontrollable merely renders her a worthy opponent. Romancing nature as foreplay for abuse. By being so aggressive, by threatening to control, nature is asking for it. Now, Unitarian minister Sherry Prudhomme and UU theologian Allison Doney have drawn the connection of the potency of this story of disconnection, of humans being separate from nature rather than a part of it. They've drawn the connection between that story and the way it creates the potential to abuse this earth with the story of how in our society we abuse and marginalize women. We've lived in these past few weeks with the news of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change giving us a stark report about the future of this climate. And we've been living in the wake of this Me Too movement in which we're wrestling with how we relate to each other and what is acceptable and what is not, what you can do with your body, what I can do with mine. And I want to read you that quote again from Neil Smith and see how these stories come together. Placing nature on a pedestal as ultimately uncontrollable merely renders her a worthy opponent. Romancing nature as foreplay for abuse by being so aggressive, by threatening to control, nature is asking for it. Simultaneously, woman and other. She is mother, mother. It's fascinating how that story that disconnects us plays over and over again. It's a story that privileges a mind over the body, saying they are different, and yet we've yet to find a difference. It's the same story that puts men over women, the same story that puts humans over the environment. It's the same story of us versus them. It's a story of disconnection, of objectification, of I get to use you for my purpose. Interdependence is easy to forget, and yet it is too important not to remember. And here we are in this little slice of Connecticut on the Front Range. The water reservoirs are at 40% of what they should be. Wildfires, floods, and droughts have been known to this community since we've ever been here. The massive population boom is increasingly straining our resources, and the choices that we make now about water conservation, about forest management, about urban planning, about whether fossil fuels will stay in the ground or be burned. It matters what we do. It matters what we say, and it matters what we think, because this is our home. There is a beautiful antidote, though, to this story of disconnection, and it is a deeply Unitarian Universalist antidote. Because Unitarian Universalists are people that don't see disconnection, but we see interconnection. And so we can use beauty, the beauty of the natural world, as a discipline for us. Witnessing that beauty, not just passing it by, really witnessing it, even if it's a little subpar beauty, right? Can't always be the Grand Canyon, but sometimes one tree is enough. There is a spiritual practice for each of us of living and seeing beauty. Because when we see and live beauty, it reminds us of the deepest truth that beauty, that immensity, that reverence we feel for this world and all of its parts is telling us, whispering to us, that we are kindred to each other. That sense of our place, whether it be small or large in the web of being, reminds us that we are a part of each other, that we are interdependent. Beauty opens that door to remember, so that when we go and make decisions that matter, we hold that truth that interdependence, while it may be easy to forget, is too costly not to remember. Hold on to that beauty. It will open the door. It will nourish us. It will sustain us. And it will pave the road to the world that we need to build for our place on it to be sustained. Amen.